Danny E. Casey Foundation.
Hi, I'm Randy Wynn. 1958 is one of the greatest years in music history. On Thursday, January 25th, The Commuter from Hell joins me to go back in the WMNF time machine 60 years. Join us to hear the timeless, influential music of 1958 on the Thursday morning show, 6 to 9 a.m., January 25th.
Good morning. Welcome to Radio Activity. I'm Rob Loright. Coming up, we're going to hear some of the speeches that were made yesterday, some of the testimony that was given yesterday in Congress. And we're going to open up the phone lines later on. There was a really powerful speech given this morning by a Republican U.S. senator. We're going to try to get that in this hour. And the history of immigration. Big debate in Washington about what to do about people who have come here illegally. We're going to talk about the history of immigration in the U.S. It's all coming up today on Radio Activity. First, one listener comment about Monday's programming. Monday, we devoted a lot of programming here on WMNF on the public affairs shows to Dr. Martin Luther King. Here's what one listener had to say.
My name is Bill Wood. I'm calling from Clearwater, and I was told to call in sometime today to express my thanks for yesterday's Monday, the holiday, where they were playing some of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speeches that some of them I've never heard. And I think it would be a great community service to hear that again sometime soon. I think all Americans should hear that. And I just wanted to express my gratitude and thanks for y'all digging up some speeches that I hadn't heard before. It was truly, truly amazing and educational and uplifting. And I wanted to say thank you.
Well, that was a listener comment that came in after the programming on Monday here on WMNF. Well, Republicans are still struggling to get their stories straight nearly a week after a meeting in which President Trump is said to have used vulgar remarks that have been criticized as racist. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen became the latest GOP official to offer an inconclusive version of the meeting. She testified at a congressional hearing yesterday that she did not hear Trump use a certain vulgarity to describe African countries, but she didn't dispute the president was using tough language. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker angrily criticized Nielsen's comments, telling her during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, "Your silence and your amnesia is complicity." We're going to hear a little bit of what happened yesterday in that Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. The person who came out, one of the senators who came out and described in graphic detail what President Trump said at last Thursday's meeting, in which the topic was immigration, was Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. We're going to hear what he said yesterday when he was questioning the Department of Homeland Security Secretary on DACA and immigration. Let's go to yesterday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearings. Here is Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois.
I hope you remember me. We were together at two meetings last week. I would like to ask you about one of those meetings. It occurred about noon on January the 11th. You were a few minutes late, I know, and asked forgiveness, but were called at the last minute to come and attend. Some things were said at that meeting which I believe we have to address today. People across the United States and around the world want to know what this president believes should be our priorities when it comes to immigration. I'm going to ask you, as best you can, to recall what you heard the president say when it came to those priorities. What do you remember the president saying about immigration from African countries to the United States?
What I heard him saying was that he'd like to move away from a country-based quota system to a merit-based system. So it shouldn't matter where you're from. It should matter what you can contribute to the United States.
How did he characterize those countries in Africa?
I don't specifically remember a categorization of countries in Africa. I think what he was saying is, as far as best I could tell, and as you know, there were about a dozen people in the room. There were a lot of cross conversations. There was a lot of rough talk by a lot of people in the room. But what I understood him to be saying is, let's move away from the countries.
I hope you remember.
Let's look at the individual and make sure that those we bring here can contribute to our society.
I would like to ask you about one of those meetings. It occurred about noon on January the 11th. You were a few minutes late, I know, and asked forgiveness, but you're called at the last minute to come and attend. Some things were said at that meeting which I believe we have to address today. People across the United States and around the world want to know what this president believes should be our priorities when it comes to immigration. I'm going to ask you, as best you can, to recall what you heard the president say when it came to those priorities. What do you remember the president saying about immigration from African countries to the United States?
What I heard him saying was that he'd like to move away from a country-based quota system to a merit-based system. So it shouldn't matter where you're from. It should matter what you can contribute to the United States.
How did he characterize those countries in Africa?
I don't specifically remember a categorization of countries in Africa. I think what he was saying is, as far as best I could tell, and as you know, there were about a dozen people in the room. There were a lot of cross conversations. There was a lot of rough talk by a lot of people in the room. But what I understood him to be saying is, let's move away from the countries and let's look at the individual and make sure that those we bring here can contribute to our society.
Do you remember the president saying expressly, I want more Europeans, why can't we have more immigrants from Norway?
I do remember him asking about the concept of underrepresented countries as a fix. This was in the conversation about removing the diversity lottery and how we could reallocate that. And I do remember him asking, if we do that and we then assign those to countries that are unrepresented, aren't we just continuing non-merit-based immigration? So from that perspective, I think he did ask, would that cover European countries, or by its nature, would that mean that we are further establishing immigration to purposefully exclude Europeans?
What did the president say about immigrants from Norway?
I heard him repeating what he had learned in a meeting before, that they are industrious, that they are a hardworking country. They don't have much crime there. They don't have much debt. I think in general, I just heard him giving compliments to Norway.
You said on Fox News that the president used strong language. What was that strong language?
Strong language, there was... I don't remember a specific word. What I was struck with, frankly, as I'm sure you were as well, was just the general profanity that was used in the room by almost everyone.
Did you hear me use profanity?
No, sir. Neither did I.
Did you hear Senator Graham use profanity?
I did hear tough language from Senator Graham, yes, sir.
What did he say?
He used tough language. He was impassioned. I think he was feeling very strongly about the issue, as was everyone in the room. And to underscore a point, I think he was using some strong language.
Do you recall that the strong language he used repeated exactly what the president had said prior to that?
I remember specific cuss words being used by a variety of members.
I'm not going to ask you to say those words here, but I will just say for the record, Senator Graham spoke up in a way that I respect very much, countering what the president had said about countries in Africa, reminding the president that his family did not come to America with great skills or wealth, but they came here as most families do, looking for a chance to prove themselves and make this a better nation. And in defense of Senator Graham, his strong words repeated exactly the words used by the president, which you cannot remember. Let me ask you another question.
If I just could, sir, I do want to say that I greatly appreciate not only Senator Graham's leadership, but yours as well. I know you're both very passionate about this. As you know, afterwards, I approached you and asked that I'm happy to come talk to you anytime to try to work on this deal. I do think that Senator Graham very impassionately described what he believes America is about and what we should move towards. Yes, I agree with that.
Do you support a path to citizenship for DACA recipients and those who were in the DREAM Act?
I think we have to find a permanent solution. Yes, sir.
I hate that phrase, permanent solution. Do you support a path to citizenship?
I believe that is part of the discussion, and to make sure that we don't continue temporary populations that continue to exist, we should talk about that. I'm not here to get in front of the president or any final decisions on that particular issue, but yes, I'm happy to discuss it.
Do you recall the president saying that he wanted $20 billion now and he would build this wall within 1 year?
I do remember him saying that he was concerned that given the appropriation cycle, that any deal that we made now would be limited to this year's appropriation. I remember him asking, is there a way to authorize the full down payment of the wall such that we could have assurances that we could, in fact, build it?
So let's take a look at what your department has done when it comes to building walls. As of December the 6th, 2017, less than 1% of the $341 million appropriated for 40 miles of replacement funding had been expended. Actual construction has yet to begin on money appropriated in the last fiscal year. So is the president realistic when he says he wants $20 billion so he can build the wall in 1 year?
I think the president is encouraging us to go as quickly as we can. As you know, it's a very complicated issue building the wall for a whole variety of reasons. What we're doing right now is we are testing and evaluating those prototypes, and we'll continue to determine the not only the design, but what's best per some of the other senators' comments for any particular part of the border, because it will be different. We need a full toolkit.
Madam Secretary, the President made it clear in that meeting that one of the conditions for his assent or agreement to protect DACA was $20 billion so he could build this wall in 1 year. The fate of John and Alejandra lies in the balance here. The President is insisting on something that is physically, legally impossible as a condition for him to give them a chance to be here in the United States legally. Now, you've seen, because you commented on it, Fox News, the proposal, which Senator Graham and I, as well as four other senators, have made on a bipartisan basis, and you've rejected it. You said at one point, I believe, that, let me see if I quote here, there's nothing in there that would prevent us from getting here again. Are you aware of the fact that included in this proposal is the entire request of the administration for border security in this fiscal year? $1.6 billion for walls and barriers and fences, and another $1 billion for technology, exactly what you asked for. If you don't believe this is going to solve the problem, which is what you said on Fox News, why did the administration request it in the first place?
Well, sir, that's not all we requested, as you know. We also requested to close the loopholes that serve as the pull factors that continue to exacerbate the problem. I cannot apprehend if I cannot remove. That's not border security.
Let me add, the first meeting we had last week, we agreed, and the president agreed, there would be two phases to this conversation. The first, immediately to deal with the DACA challenge and the three other elements the president
including raised. Border security,
including
sir.
Including border security, every penny that you ask for. And then the president said phase two goes into comprehensive immigration reform, many of the issues which you described as must-haves. We understand that. To put the entire burden of immigration reform on the shoulders of these DACA recipients is fundamentally unfair, not practical, and jeopardizes their future and their lives. What we're trying to do is an honest, bipartisan approach to deal with the first phase of this, and you have rejected it.
I thank you for your passion. I hope you understand mine. I cannot agree to a deal that does not give the tools and resources to the men and women of Department of Homeland Security to do the job you've asked them to do.
We gave you every penny you asked for.
Sir, it's not the pennies. No. It's closing the loopholes.
Then can we cut back on some of this money, because we can sure use it?
We need the wall, too. The wall works, as you know. It's part of border security.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, that was Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen speaking with Senator Dick Durbin, being questioned by Senator Durbin from Illinois. He's a Democrat. Some tough questions about the wall and tough questions about last Thursday's controversial meeting, much publicized meeting, which President Trump allegedly called several countries S-holes. And you can comment about this. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, another Democrat, criticized Nielsen at yesterday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearings. We're going to listen to some of that right now. Here is Senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker, questioning Department of Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I just want to say about the doctor chairman issue.
To me, this is a very profound moral issue in our country. It's a moral issue because, as you know, many of these children do not have even memories of their home country. And now in our nation, they're doing things that are extraordinary. In my state, we have DACA recipients, dreamers who are servants in the military. We have dreamers who are first responders. We have dreamers who are entrepreneurs. One young lady sat in my office and employs hundreds and hundreds of people. And I'm sure you're aware, because you've probably met with these people, correct? You've met with dreamers, yes?
I have not met with DACA recipients as Secretary of Homeland Security, no, sir.
Have you met with them before, dreamers before?
Not as self-identified, no.
So then for your knowledge, a lot of these folks are now hanging not only in the balance of waiting for policy, but it's a grievous anxiety. It's undermining their life and their well-being and their ability to serve. This moment for them, these weeks and weeks of waiting on something where 80% of Americans agree, Republicans and Democrats agree, that we should find a way for these folks to stay in this country. What is happening to them right now is unacceptable treatment to people who are fellow Americans, but for the documentation. I want to just turn, though, and you'll have to forgive me, listening to the testimony has changed my line of questioning a bit, because this is very personal to me. I sit here right now because when good white people in this country heard bigotry or hatred, they stood up. Moving into my home community, we were denied housing because of the color of our skin. And there was white Americans from Bergen County who banded together to fight against racism, to fight against hate speech, to fight against people who had broad brush generalities about people based upon their ethnicity, based upon their origin, based upon their religion. What went on in the White House, what went on in the Oval Office, is profoundly disturbing to me. And I'll tell you this, I heard about it when I was in Puerto Rico when it happened. And here I was there trying to help a community dealing with savage challenges. I can't tell you how many Puerto Ricans brought up that conversation in the White House. I returned to Atlanta to go to the King Center Awards. And from the greatest luminaries from the Civil Rights Movement down to average Americans, this was on their mind. I returned to Newark, New Jersey, and I talked to African Americans from Africa. I talked to Central American Americans. I talked to regular Newarkers, and this was top on their mind. Yesterday, I talked to the ambassador from Haiti, and to see all that they're doing as a result of this conversation. Now, I've been in the Oval Office many times, and when the commander-in-chief speaks, I listened. I don't have amnesia on conversations I had in the Oval Office going back months and months and months. And I've had individual meetings with the president, and I've had group conversations where there was, as you said, crosstalk. And why is this so important? Why is this so disturbing for me? Why am I, frankly, seething with anger? We have this incredible nation where we have been taught that it does not matter where you're from, it doesn't matter your color, your race, or religion, it's about the content of your character. It's about your values and your ideals. And yet we have language that from Dick Durbin to Lindsey Graham, they seem to have a much better recollection of what went on. You're under oath. You and others in that room that suddenly cannot remember. It was Martin Luther King that said, there's nothing in this world more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. And so here we are in the United States of America. And we have a history that is beautiful and grand and
all so ugly. Where from this nation to others, we know what happens when people sit by and are bystanders and say nothing. When Oval Office rhetoric sounds like social engineering, we know from human history the dangers of that. Our greatest heroes in this country spoke out about people who have convenient amnesia or who are bystanders. King said, a man dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is right. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice. A man dies when he refuses to take a stand. Elie Wiesel says, we must take side. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages a tormentor, never the tormented. Gandhi said, silence becomes cowardice. Cowardice when the occasion demands speaking out like Lindsey Graham did, and acting accordingly. This idea that the commander-in-chief of this country could with broad brushes talk about certain nations and thus cast a shadow over the millions of Americans who are from those communities, and that you could even say in your testimony the Norwegians were preferenced by him because they're so hardworking.
Let me finish. Happy to.
Let me just draw a connection of why that matters. I'm sure you remember the six words from our president, the six words that he said after Charleston, Virginia last summer. People marching with tiki torches and hate, when he said there are very fine people on both sides. Very fine people on both sides. When the commander-in-chief speaks or refuses to speak, those words just don't dissipate like mist in the air. They fester. They become poison. They give license to bigotry and hate in our country. I know you're aware of a 2017 GAO report that found, and I quote, out of the 85 violent extremist incidences that resulted in death since September 12, 2001, far right-wing violent extremist groups were responsible for 73%. When I go through the Black Belt in the South, when I'm in Atlanta, black churches in Newark, they're concerned about jihadist Islamic terrorism. We watched the Twin Towers from Newark go down. But since 9/11, 85 violent incidents, 73%. We're with people that hold bigoted, hateful ideas about minorities. One American killed in Charleston, Virginia, and dozens injured. Nine Americans killed in a church shooting in Charleston, South Carolina by a white supremacist. An American killed and another wounded in Kansas after a white supremacist targeted them for their ethnicity, saying, get out of my country. Six Americans killed and four others wounded in Wisconsin, where white supremacists targeted individuals for their religion. The commander-in-chief, in an Oval Office meeting, referring to people from African countries and Haitians with the most vile and vulgar language. That language festers. When ignorance and bigotry is allied with power, it is a dangerous force in our country. Your silence and your amnesia is complicity. Right now in our nation, we have a problem. I don't know if 73% of your time is spent on white supremacist hate groups. I don't know if 73% of your time is spent concerned about the people in fear in communities in this country, Sikh Americans, Muslim Americans, black Americans. The fact pattern is clear of the threats in this country. I hurt. When Dick Durbin called me, I had tears of rage when I heard about his experience in that meeting. And for you not to feel that hurt and that pain and to dismiss some of the questions of my colleagues saying I've already answered that line of questions when tens of millions of Americans are hurting right now because of what they're worried about what happened in the White House, that's unacceptable to me. There are threats in this country. People plotting. I receive enough death threats to know the reality. Kamala receives enough death threats to know the reality. Maisie receives enough death threats to know the reality. And I've got a president of the United States whose office I respect, who talks about the countries of origins of my fellow citizens in the most despicable of manner. You don't remember. You can't remember the words of your commander-in-chief. I find that unacceptable. Mr. Chairman, I'm grateful to be on this committee. I'm more than ever today happy I am here. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Graham.
Sir, could I just respond, if you don't mind, after that? I would just like to say that...
Wait, Senator Graham. Go ahead and respond.
Would that be okay?
Yeah.
I would just like to say I do clearly, and I want to be clear on this, abhor violence in all of its forms. I couldn't agree with you more that the Department of Homeland Security has a duty to stop and prevent violence in all of its forms. Our preventing terrorism programs have been reassessed and relooked at just this year to ensure that we actually are going after the threats, to include white supremacy, not just to focus on what was focused on in years past. So I would just like to say that to you. I share your passion. It's unacceptable. It can't be tolerated in the United States. Under the authorities that I have at the Department of Homeland Security, violence in any form will not be tolerated.
Senator Graham.
All right, so that was Senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker, questioning Kristen Nielsen, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary yesterday, actually making a statement about his concerns, especially over last Thursday's meeting at the White House on immigration. Immigration has really touched off a big controversy, so I figured we'd spend a little bit of time today talking about the history of immigration here to the U.S. We're going to speak with Tyler Anbinder. He's a professor of history at George Washington University, and he's the author of a major work. It's called City of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrant New York. Here's the interview with Tyler Anbinder, who is an expert on the history of immigration to the U.S. Tyler Anbinder, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I wanted to bring you on because you're an expert on immigration, and I want to go through the kind of ABCs of immigration history with you, starting with those folks who have ancestors that came here in the 1800s or early 1900s. Did their ancestors have to wait in line? Did they apply to come in, or did they just show up?
No, they didn't have to wait on line. That's one of the biggest misconceptions in American immigration history is the question of, you know, why don't today's immigrants wait on line like our grandparents did? And in fact, there was no line for immigrants to wait on in the 18th, 19th century, really up until 1965. Until 1965, immigrants could pretty much come to the United States in unlimited numbers. That was totally the case up until the early 20th century. Then the United States started putting some restrictions in place that applied to everyone except the Chinese, and then everyone except all Asians. But for most of American history, there was no wait. You just simply got on the ship, you came, and as long as you passed the health inspection at Ellis Island, you were welcomed into the United States. So the whole part about having to wait on a line to get in is a very recent development in American history.
So when I hear people say, why don't these new immigrants come here like my immigrants did and do it legally, in all likelihood, if their families came here in the 1800s or early 1900s, they just showed up.
They just showed up.
Wow.
And the other misconception is that today's illegal immigrants could be legal immigrants if they waited online, which is also not true. The reason that most illegal immigrants come here illegally is because they cannot immigrate legally. These days, since 1965, almost all the immigration slots are held for the family members of people who are already here. The only exception is people with very sought-after skills, you know, computer programmers, doctors, nurses, things like that. If you're not one of those things and you don't have a relative already in the United States, there's no line for you to wait on. There's no way for you to get in legally. And that's why illegal immigration, which was pretty much unknown for most of American history, has become such a big thing in the last 30 or so years.
There is right now, on the part of some, a fear of these new immigrants, that they don't want these folks to come in. In the 400-year history of immigration to the U.S., How many generations have seen at least some example of fear of new immigrants?
Fear of new immigrants is a constant in American history. Americans have always feared the impact that new immigrants will have. So you go, you know, all the way back to the very beginnings of American history, before we even become our own independent country. You have the English who are first here, and they don't like the Scots, and they think the Scots are going to ruin America and can't fit in. And then the English and the Scots look at the Irish who start coming in the 1700s, and they say, oh, we don't want those Irish. Those Irish will never make good Americans. And you get to the mid-19th century, and that becomes even more so when the Irish who are coming to the United States are very poor due to the potato famine, and there's huge movements against the Irish and efforts to ban them, but efforts that fail. And then the same thing is said about the Germans, and then the Italians, and then Eastern Europeans, and so on and so forth. So every new wave of immigrants has been feared by Americans, and every new wave, it's been believed by native-born Americans, can't possibly fit in. And yet what we find is those groups all, in the end, fit in, and then they become part of the group that fears the next wave.
Now, the question of cultural assimilation, a lot of people are saying about the latest wave of immigrants, no matter where they're coming from, they say these folks can't possibly learn our language, they're not going to assimilate into American culture, they don't understand American culture, and so, therefore, if we let them in, American culture is going to be changed for the worst, and they're going to be isolated, they're not going to interact with us. I mean, you hear this all the time. What's the history of that?
Well, there's two parts to that history. The first part is that's based on a mistaken belief that previous generations of immigrants assimilated. The truth is people who come to America as adults have never really assimilated very much. They always tend to look at the country of their birth as the place they call quote-unquote home. They look at American values as kind of foreign and things that they're afraid of. They continue to be nostalgic for the place of their birth. They miss the foods. They miss the music. They miss the landscape. And so when we think back and we think, oh, Americans in the past assimilated so much more, it's just really not true. But then the other thing is what has happened is it's the children of those immigrants who have always assimilated. In fact, the children of immigrants tend to be kind of super American. They want to kind of get rid of every piece of evidence that they have any foreign background. And so the children of immigrants are kind of super assimilators, and they are extremely patriotic, extremely American, and that's been the case for hundreds of years. So just as kids always want to kind of separate themselves from their parents, the way immigrant kids do that is by adopting everything American. And so there's really no change from the past to today. Adult immigrants don't assimilate very much, but that's never been much of a problem for America.
We're talking with Tyler Anbinder. He's a professor of history at George Washington University, and he's the author of the book City of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrant New York. Tyler, you point out that there have been these enclaves where new arrivals come here, and they don't assimilate before the second generation begins to assimilate. You point to something in New York called Klein Deutschland. What was Klein Deutschland?
Klein Deutschland was the German neighborhood in New York City, and it's actually bigger than a neighborhood. It was really made up of you know, seven or eight neighborhoods. So a huge part of 19th century New York, where if you'd gone there, you would not hear a word of English spoken. All the signs were in German. All the languages being spoken in German. If you went into a business and tried to speak English, people would probably not be able to communicate you. It was that German. The immigrants would write home and they'd say, this is great. It's like I'm still in Stuttgart, or it's like I'm still in Bavaria. That's how German everything is here in this part of New York. And that's what pretty much all immigrants did. You had Irish neighborhoods, you had German neighborhoods, later you'd have Italian neighborhoods where the immigrants would say, you know, I didn't have to learn English until my kids went to school, because everything I needed. Every store I had to go to, every person I had to talk to spoke Italian. And that's what you've had, and that's not just in New York City. You had in the Midwest, you had the exact same kinds of things happening in German enclaves, Scandinavian enclaves. Not only did everybody speak English, but they even set up public schools where school would be taught in German, in Norwegian, and things like that. So there's a long history of immigrants kind of sticking to their language and not assimilating very much. And it goes back throughout all of American history.
Today, one of the fears is of the Muslim religious groups that are coming in. You point out in your book, City of Dreams, that there's been fear over the last 400 years of new religious groups coming in, fear of people who are Jewish, people who are Catholic. Talk about just describe the kind of anti-Catholic feelings that were here in the U.S. maybe 150 years ago.
Anti-Catholic sentiment was huge for most of American history, really. I mean, if you think about it, you know, even as late as the election of 1960 with JFK, lots of people refused to vote for him because he was Catholic. So anti-Catholicism has a long American history, and it was especially intense in the 19th century. And there were lots of Americans who believed that Catholicism was completely incompatible with being a good American, that to be a good American, you had to be independent-minded. And they believed Catholics weren't independent-minded, that they had to follow the dictates of the Pope and their head, his bishops and priests. And they thought that you had to be a believer in science to make progress, and that Catholics didn't believe in science. You know, they had persecuted Galileo and so forth. And it seemed to Protestant Americans that everything that Catholicism seemed to stand for was antithetical to what the United States stood for. And so there are millions of Americans who believe that you could not be a good Catholic and be a good American. And so there was a movement, the Know Nothing Party was the most famous example, where they pushed to allow Catholics to immigrate, but not allow them to become citizens. Kind of sounds familiar. And they could immigrate, they could work, they could do the jobs nobody else wanted to do, but they couldn't be citizens and couldn't vote. That was the proposal, because it was said they couldn't be good Americans. Those proposals never became law, but still it shows the extent of the anti-Catholicism of the day.
Did the people that were here believe that the new immigrants were less clean or were filthy or somehow didn't have the same kind of sanitary habits that Americans who were already here had?
Exactly. So throughout American history, there's been this fear that immigrants are, among the other things that are bad about them, is that they bring disease. And so in the 19th century with the Irish, there were things like typhus, and diseases like that you could get on board the immigrant ships. Before that, immigrants were said to bring smallpox during the American Revolutionary period. And then by the end of the 19th century, these other diseases that became so chronic, like diphtheria and whooping cough, and tuberculosis, were all said to be things that immigrants brought. And that became part of the movement to ban immigrants, with the belief that immigrants were disease-ridden and that they would infect America. I should point out that the statistics show that wasn't true, that immigrants did not get these diseases any more often than other Americans. But nativists, people who wanted to limit immigration or eliminate it altogether, seized on kind of fears and stereotypes to try to make these things part of their agenda.
You also say in your book, and we're talking with Tyler Anbinder, who is the author of City of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrant New York. You also say in your book that new immigrant groups like the Jewish immigrant groups, the Italian immigration, that engendered a new wave of white supremacism here in the U.S. How did it do that?
Well, you had among certain segments of the American population, a belief that what defined America, what defined the United States, was white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. And so just as you had in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, kind of a white supremacist movement that was capped by Hitler and the Nazis, Hitler and the Nazis had their followers in the United States, and you would have huge parades of American Nazis, that made what we had in Charlottesville a few weeks ago look tiny by comparison. Luckily, you did not typically have violence with these things that you have now. But just for example, the New York Nazis, and you might think New York would not be the place that Nazis would be very big. But in New York, the Nazis filled Madison Square Garden with 20,000 cheering followers in the late 1930s. And so this was a huge movement. And these were people who believed that only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants could be true Americans and that everybody else should be eliminated.
So in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there begins to be these calls for Washington to limit immigration. And President Teddy Roosevelt at one point says, yeah, let's limit immigration because we want to prevent race suicide. This is Teddy Roosevelt, the progressive.
Correct. Well, Roosevelt is interesting in that he, over the course of his presidency even, kind of changes his view. So at the beginning of his presidency, he's one of these believers in Anglo-Saxon greatness and belief that Anglo-Saxonism is what makes the United States great. When he becomes president, and among other things, he appoints the first American Jew to his cabinet, the first Jew to serve in a presidential cabinet. And as he learns more, he changes. And so by the second term of his administration, he stopped calling for restrictions on immigration to limit the non-Anglo-Saxon Protestants. But this idea of race suicide that he talked about was this idea that the American race, which he was defining as Anglo-Saxon, was going to die out. And it wasn't a murder. It was, he said, suicide, because he said if Americans weren't having enough babies and the immigrants would come and have families with six or eight babies, the Catholics and the Jews, while the American Anglo-Saxon Protestants would only have, say, two. And he said, we're going to be, the white Protestants are going to be overwhelmed by the Jews and the Catholics if we Americans don't have more babies. But by his second term of his presidency, he stopped saying those things and started embracing immigrants from all religious backgrounds. And so that was a very interesting and to me, commendable thing.
And real echoes of today in his first term.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Tyler Ann Binder, thank you so much. I know you've got to go back and teach some classes today. So thank you so much for spending time with us. Great to have you here.
It's been my pleasure.
That was Tyler Anbinder, professor of history at George Washington University. He's the author of a really impressive book called City of Dreams, the 400-Year Epic History of Immigrant New York. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. If you want to comment about something you've heard here so far as we talk about the big controversy of the day, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Now, just a few minutes ago, Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona made a speech on the floor of the Senate. It's gaining a lot of attention because he compared President Trump to former Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. Let's listen to the opening of that speech by Jeff Flake.
So, from the very beginning, our freedom has been predicated on truth. The founders were visionary in this regard, understanding well that good faith and shared facts between the governed and the government would be the very basis of this ongoing idea of America. As a distinguished former member of this body, Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York, famously said, everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not his own facts. Now, during this past year, I'm alarmed to say that Senator Moynihan's proposition has likely been tested more severely than at any time in our history. For it is that reason that I rise today to talk about the truth and the truth's relationship to democracy. For without truth and a principled fidelity to truth and to shared facts, Mr. President, our democracy will not last. 2017 was a year which saw the truth, objective, empirical, evidence-based truth, more battered and abused than at any time in the history of our country, at the hands of the most powerful figure in our government. It was a year which saw the White House enshrine alternative facts into the American lexicon as justification for what used to be simply called old-fashioned falsehoods. It was a year in which an unrelenting daily assault on the constitutionally protected free speech was launched by the same White House, an assault that is as unprecedented as it is unwarranted. The enemy of the people was how the President of the United States called the free press in 2017. Mr. President, it is a testament to the condition of our democracy that our own president uses words infamously spoken by Joseph Stalin to describe his enemies. It bears noting that so fraught with malice was the phrase enemy of the people that even Nikita Khrushchev forbade its use, telling the Soviet Communist Party that the phrase had been introduced by Stalin for the purpose of, quote, annihilating such individuals, unquote, who disagreed with the supreme leader. This alone should be the source of great shame for us in this body, especially for those of us in the president's party, for they are shameful, repulsive statements. And of course, the president has it precisely backward. Despotism is the enemy of the people. The free press is the despot's enemy, which makes the free press the guardian of democracy. When a figure in power reflexively calls any press that doesn't suit him fake news, it is that person who should be the figure of suspicion, not the press. I dare say that anyone who has had the privilege and awesome responsibility to serve in this chamber knows that these reflexive slurs of fake news are dubious at best. Those of us who travel overseas, especially to war zones and other troubled areas all around the globe, encounter members of U.S.-based media who risk their lives and sometimes lose their lives reporting on the truth. To dismiss their work as fake news is an affront to their commitment and their sacrifice.
Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, a Republican, just minutes ago on the floor of the Senate, criticizing President Trump using a term called enemy of the people when he's describing the press. Well, let's open up the phone lines. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Greg writes this, Nielsen, Department of Homeland Security Secretary, responded to Senator Booker by saying that she abhors violence in all its forms and that her department is not ignoring violence by white supremacists. A new report from DHS and the Justice Department on terrorism convictions entirely omitted domestic terrorism, writes Greg. And so he goes on to say, so she blatantly lied under oath. I believe this is perjury. And yet this is where most of the terrorism in the U.S. comes from. Domestic sources being ignored points to scapegoating, projecting the blame onto foreign terrorists to deflect blame from domestic white supremacists who are responsible for most of the terrorism that is perpetrated in the U.S. That's part of Greg's email. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. And Jeff Haynes is our phone producer today. We're going to go to Sean, who is in Tampa. Hi, Sean, you're on. What would you like to comment about?
Yeah, you know, I just want to talk about the comparison between Joseph Stalin and the president. I'm going to say right off the bat that I don't agree with a lot of things that Donald Trump does. I don't think he's a very eloquent speaker. I think that he speaks more like the average individual than somebody that would be the head of state. But we all know throughout history, you know, Joseph Stalin was an anarchist that was put in a German jail and released to destroy a country that was against Germany. And he murdered millions and millions upon millions of people, and he was a sociopath. You know, Trump's none of those people. Trump didn't grow up in Soviet Russia. He's not a Marxist. And I could go on and on and on.
Sean, the question is, where do dictatorships begin? How do they begin?
Well, they begin with somebody's idea.
Right. They start. They don't start killing millions of people. They start by gaining power and influencing government and gradually taking it over. So where do dictatorships begin? They begin small. So how do you, if Jeff Flake is concerned that President Trump is using the language of a dictator, isn't that okay to say? I mean, shouldn't, if Jeff Flake, who's a libertarian, he's a Republican, if he feels concerned, shouldn't he say that?
You know, I really don't. I think if you want to address such things in a proper professional manner against or amongst people that are
all right. So how do you address it? What's the better way to address it?
Okay, so let me go back because you're driving a conversation here.
Well, I've only got 4 minutes. I've got every line lit, and I want to let me just give you 30 seconds. How would you address it?
You know, I would address it with Trump personally, and I would address it with Trump's team because somebody's writing Trump's.
So you would go to So you would go to the president personally and say you're using the language of Joseph Stalin. All right. Well, that's a fair point. So don't make it public. Just go to the president personally. All right, Sean. We heard you. Thanks a lot. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Jill in St. Petersburg. Hi, Jill. What would you like to say?
Yes, I'd like to address your question. First of all, I'd like to answer the gentleman who was just on the air. I think he's absolutely wrong. I think the way dictatorships begin is the way that Donald Trump is beginning, by suppression. He's suppressing the press. He's not suppressing them, but he's trying to suppress them. He's trying to point a finger at them, like many other dictators have done to people who have had an opposing view. This isn't what America's all about. I really believe, I've always believed that he is dictatorial in manner, dictatorial in speech, and in every way possible. I am really afraid that he is trying to take dictatorial powers, and each and every day it worries me, it bothers me. And I am very proud that for a change, one of the Republican body of the Senate has stood up and said something, because it's been about time that somebody has stood up against this horrible suppression that's taking place by Donald Trump.
All right, Jill, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. Nina writes this, tell us about the restrictions on immigrants from Asian countries, i.e. Chinese and Indian, please. Our guest, Tyler Anbinder, did talk about that a little bit. The Chinese Exclusion Act of the late 1800s, I believe it was around 1880, began closing the doors on immigrants. And then there were other laws that were passed. There were laws began to exclude other groups. And Nina, thanks. It's a good point, is that the restrictions on immigration really began with laws against people of color from countries like China, and then it grew beyond that. Let's go to Elizabeth in Riverview. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on. What would you like to say?
First of all, I am in no way saying that this dear president of ours is anything other than a jerk and stupid and all of that, but he is dangerous. However, what I would like to do is go back in history a long, long way now. We are talking about immigrants coming here to America and changing us and not changing us and one thing and another. Let's go way back. Let's go back to when the Native Americans were Indians. And what happened to them? You've heard of the Trail of Tears, haven't you?
Yeah. And
the original settlers, European settlers, to America did.
They displaced the people that were here, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a pretty well-known story. We talk about that a lot, too, Elizabeth. So, but what do you think about, you know, this controversy today where the president is denying using these words about Africa and Central America?
Of course he's going to deny them. For goodness sakes, he opens his fat mouth and he doesn't have any control over what's going to come out. It's just him being stupid, which he is. In a smart way, of course, or he wouldn't be where he is now.
But Elizabeth, a lot of people like the president, you know, still 30-35% of the country thinks he's doing a fine job.
Well,
what would you say to them?
Come on. What can you say? Wait, he will go away, that's for sure. He'll go away and we'll recover. And that's about all you can hope for, I guess.
Okay. All right, Elizabeth, thanks a lot. Thank you very much. Thanks. We're just about out of time. We're getting, there are a few emails here, but they're all kind of disconnected. I think sometimes email doesn't serve its purpose when people can just write 5 or 6 words and then stop. But if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment about this show on this extension 115. And we'll play your comments about this show tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned because Nola's back. He was away last week, and he'll be hosting the Midpoint program next. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for listening. We're going to get the latest news from National Public Radio in just a moment, including more about that speech by Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, who made a big speech this morning on the Senate floor. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota.